Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. A top Democratic lawmaker says he was in the room yesterday when President Trump used vulgar language to dismiss a deal on immigration that would have included protections for people from Haiti and parts of Africa. Democratic Senator Dick Durbin, who was in that meeting, spoke to reporters this morning.
You've seen the comments in the press. I have not read one of them that's inaccurate. To no surprise, the president started tweeting this morning, denying that he used those words. It is not true. He said these hate-filled things, and he said them repeatedly.
And a warning now that I am about to say the word attributed to the president in the Oval Office meeting yesterday. We're going to use the word one time because NPR believes it is important to give you the full context and because of the impact of those comments. President Trump reportedly said, "Why are we having all these people from shithole countries come here?" That was after lawmakers told him a bipartisan immigration deal would include people from Haiti and some African countries. He also said the U.S. should admit more people from Norway, which is a majority white country. The comments have brought up major questions today about the future of an immigration deal in Congress. And for more on all of this, we are bringing in NPR's White House correspondent Scott Horsley. Scott, hello.
Good afternoon.
Today, the president appeared to deny that he made those comments. Senator Durbin says that he did. Can you clarify how the White House and the president are responding to this?
Well, it's important to note that when these reports first surfaced last evening of the president's vulgar slur, there was no denial from the White House. There was a sort of contextual statement from a press aide, but no actual rejection of that the president used the term. The president offered a sort of half-hearted correction this morning, but as you heard, Dick Durbin says the word that's been attributed to him is the word the president used, not just once, but repeatedly. And Durbin's account has been backed up by Republican Senator Jeff Flake, who was not in the meeting, but says he was told about it and about the president's vocabulary immediately after by people who were in attendance. Jeff Flake says the words were not tough, which is what the president said. They were, he said, abhorrent and repulsive.
The context here, of course, is that they were in the White House to speak about immigration, to speak about policy. What was the president actually referring to? What part of this discussion?
Well, this again is key because whatever dispute there may be over the word the president used, there's no dispute about what his feelings are on the policy. The president wants fewer immigrants from countries in Africa. He wants more immigrants from countries like Norway. It's pretty easy to read what that means. And it's also important to note Norwegians aren't exactly knocking down the door to get into the United States.
Right.
All of this raises the challenge for the lawmakers who are trying to deal with the situation created by this president when he began phasing out the special protection for young immigrants in the country illegally who were brought here as children. Those folks are facing a March deadline when they will again start being subject to deportation. That's the rub that lawmakers have been trying to deal with. And the president, even though he said earlier this week he would go along with whatever agreement lawmakers could make, the president is now backtracking on that and saying he wants something different.
Exactly. I mean, that context is very important because of those dreamers, the people who were brought to this country illegally by their parents, there's up to 700,000 of those people who are now looking at Washington, looking at the White House, wondering what their future is. I mean, you got into this a little bit, but I mean, what are the chances? Dick Durbin says that the chances that reaching this deal with the White House don't look good.
He said the chances that they would make a deal with the White House died in that meeting yesterday. But he is convinced that there is a majority, a bipartisan majority in both the House and the Senate that would favor some sort of protection for the Dreamers. And certainly polls suggest that there is bipartisan support for that around the country and among the American public. So Durbin says he's not giving up. You could certainly hear the frustration in his voice as he talked about this morning. He and a group of six senators, three Democrats and three Republicans, have been working for months to try to craft a deal. They thought they had one, only to see it torpedoed by the president yesterday.
House Speaker Paul Ryan did make some comments today about this. He called Trump's remarks unfortunate and unhelpful. What else are we hearing about Republicans? Because it seems like some of them are separating themselves from the president on this.
That's right. Susan Collins also described the president's verbiage in critical terms today. Paul Ryan, spoke about his own family's Irish heritage and how they came to this country to work on the railroads and faced similar opposition from the entrenched population of America at that time. Every wave of new immigrants faces this kind of backlash, and sadly there's a long tradition of nativism and anti-immigrant sentiment in this country. House Speaker Paul Ryan says, those successive waves of immigration are part of what helps to make this country exceptional. He also pointed to doctors in his hometown of Janesville who came here from Africa, and he called them incredible citizens and said it's important that the country celebrate that. The irony here is, the president was signing a proclamation today for Martin Luther King Day, and he talked about Dr. King opening America's eyes to what the president called the self-evident truth that no matter what the color of your skin or where you come from, you are blessed with equal dignity. It's sort of hard to square that with what he said last night.
All right. NPR's White House correspondent Scott Horsley, thank you.
Good to be with you, Peter.
Well, the Congressional Hispanic Caucus says in a statement today that President Trump's comments about Haiti, El Salvador, and several African countries are, quote, shameful, abhorrent, unpresidential, and deserving of the strongest condemnation. New Mexico Democrat Michelle Lujan Grisham is chairwoman of the Congressional Hispanic Caucus. Now, I spoke with her yesterday about an immigration deal that was before President Trump's comments, and I asked her whether any DACA deal that didn't give a pathway to citizenship for young immigrants and their parents was a non-starter.
It is, and it's a non-starter for certainly the Democratic caucus in the House. For all the obvious reasons, right? You don't want a second class set of citizens inside the United States. We don't want to create more issues that we have to address later. And these young people know no other country than this one as their own. And they've done everything that has been asked of them. And we want to set those values and principles which are aimed at preventing and eliminating discrimination. And so those would be non-starters. And we feel good that those are not places that most members of Congress who are working on these issues are going.
Well, as Representative Goodlatte, for example, is co-sponsoring a bill that does not include any kind of pathway to citizenship. That's kind of on the hard
or
line.
Or permanency, right?
Exactly. That's on the hard line side of things. But yesterday we also spoke with Representative Hurd about his bill that he's co-sponsoring with Congressman Aguilar, which does have that pathway, along with what he's calling a smart wall.
There has been a very steady, clear movement by many Republicans that a pathway to citizenship must be included. And so while we've got some members that clearly disagree, and Goodlatte is one of them, that's the minority, and a minority voice here I don't think wins the day in any efforts to find a permanent solution for DACA.
Mm. Well, so given that, just on the DACA front, I'm going to ask you about border security in a second, but do you feel confident about the fact that a bill could emerge that would get Democratic support or support from the Congressional Hispanic Caucus?
So I do, and I think having Aguilar as an original co-sponsor of Will Hurd's bill is a great signal. I want to be really clear that the Hispanic caucus, well before my time on that caucus, and certainly before my time as chairwoman, has been very clear that a guiding principle for comprehensive immigration reform and for issues related to Dreamers is that a wall is a non-starter. It's one of those red lines. Interior enforcement, more detention beds, and a wall.
In Congressman Hurd's bill, there is what he calls a smart wall. So why is that okay?
If it's technology and drones, and the impact is in areas where you would never put a wall, it doesn't make any sense, then that's probably defensible. Roads is an example, equipment right at border crossings that help you both x-ray vehicles and really look for drugs like fentanyl. Those are all things that we think improve border security. Because it's called a smart wall, doesn't is not in and of itself an indication to the Hispanic caucus or other Democrats that we're building a 2,000-mile structure. The devil will be in those details. Mm. I have described this precarious process in this way. We are threading a tiny needle, and that eye of that needle is nearly microscopically small, and I'm using a rope. But I still believe that members of Congress, both sides of the aisle, the House and the Senate, can come together. And I know that many of the folks that we have been working with for months are now ready to identify those details and come together in a meaningful way next week.
That's Representative Michelle Lujan Grisham. She's chairwoman of the Congressional Hispanic Caucus. I spoke with her yesterday before the president's widely criticized vulgar words about Haiti, El Salvador, and some African nations. In a statement today, Grisham said, quote, "Now Congress must set the example by rising above this comment and finding bipartisan solutions to the issues before us." President Donald Trump tweeted that he's canceling his planned trip to London to open the new U.S. embassy there. Why? Well, he claims the Obama administration sold the old embassy for, quote, peanuts in a bad deal. Let's get the view from the U.K. Paul Adams is BBC's diplomatic correspondent. He joins us from London. And first of all, Paul, the actual decision to sell the old U.S. embassy's location was made by the Bush administration. But like any real estate deal, things are complicated. So what's the truth here?
Yeah, and you can, you know, perhaps understand why the real estate magnate has cast his beady eye on this, the particulars of this particular deal. Yes, you're right. The initial decision to move was taken during the presidency of George W. Bush. The argument being that essentially a building that had been occupied since 1960 was no longer fit for the kind of security, particularly the security dimensions that any modern embassy building demands. The negotiations then continued on into the Obama presidency. We don't know exactly what the amount paid by Qatari investors was for the building, but it is thought to have been affected by the fact that in 2009, the building was made a building of special architectural interest. And that, while a distinction, tends to have the effect of reducing a building's value because it means that you can't do what you want to do with the exterior and so forth. And perhaps that's why Donald Trump, who, of course, likes to have a go at anything that has Barack Obama's signature on it, an excuse to have a go again.
Right. You know, and President Trump also tweeted that he believes the new embassy is in a, quote, off location. Now, London is a vast city. I was looking at the map of where Nine Elms Road is. It's in a great location. It's on the south bank of the Thames River, right across from Westminster, as far as I can tell. So, I mean, is that an off location?
You know, if you'd asked someone 10 years ago, could you envisage the U.S. embassy being south of the river, people would have looked at you in disbelief. That area has been, you know, was until relatively recently a fairly rough workaday part of London, close to the Battersea Dogs Home for retrieved dogs and a large produce market. But it is an up-and-coming regenerating area. I pass it on the train every time I come in from where I live. And, you know, that area has been utterly transformed in the last 5 years. So it is, if you like, the decision to move there was something of a vote of confidence in the regeneration of this part of London. And consequently, a lot of people are rather proud of that fact.
Right. I mean, you would think that a real estate magnate would approve of that. Get in while prices are manageable and ride the up and coming wave of a rising neighborhood. But moving on, what is the reaction there in London to the president saying he's not going to visit?
Do you want the diplomatic answer or
no? I want the truth.
Well, I suppose for a lot of Londoners, and it won't come as any great surprise to many of your listeners to know that Donald Trump is not the most popular president of recent times. So many Londoners, frankly, will have said, well, good riddance. There had been the prospect, talked about by some politicians here, of large-scale protests among people who, frankly, do not think that Donald Trump has any business being here. Interestingly, the mayor of London, Sadiq Khan, put out a message today saying that President Trump had got the message from Londoners who find his policies and actions the polar opposite of our city's values of inclusion, diversity and tolerance. That in turn led to a furious comment from Britain's Foreign Secretary, Boris Johnson, who attacked the Mayor of London for endangering UK-US relations and called him, in classic Boris Johnson language, a puffed-up, pompous popinjay.
Great. Adults on all sides of this issue. OK, so finally, the president says he's not going to open the UN-US embassy in London, but a facsimile of him has shown up there. I mean, this is just adding absurdity to insult, but we're seeing pictures of a wax figure of Donald Trump there at the embassy.
Yes, Madame Tussauds, the famous waxworks company, has sensed an opportunity today, in the light of this whole row, to send their model of Donald Trump to the grounds of the embassy. I don't know how long the figure will stay there outside the embassy, whether it might be there in a slightly provocative fashion when the embassy opens next month, perhaps not. But it certainly gave a lot of people an opportunity to go there today and take that precious selfie.
Well, Paul Adams is the BBC's diplomatic correspondent speaking to us from London. Paul, thank you so very much.
You're welcome.
That precious selfie. Look, this story is going to trend on social media, so let's bring in Femi Okeh. She's host of The Stream
going
on Al Jazeera
England. It is trending.
It's trending right now. Femi, look, we're going to talk about the big story that's going on in this country in a minute. But while we're talking about London and Trump, is social media, you know, believe him that he's canceled this trip to London because he doesn't like the deal with the embassy?
Well, Peter, think happy dance. Online Londoners and online Brits are doing a happy dance right now that they've heard that President Trump is no longer coming to the UK. Large helpings of sarcasm as well. And I can announce that a new meme has emerged. The meme starts, "I cancelled my trip to London," and then you hear what the reason might be.
Uh-huh.
Let me give you an example. Here's Mark Declan on Twitter. "The reason I cancelled my trip to London is that I am not a big fan of lorry and lift, two British words. Mm-hmm. Why won't you just talk American?" And one more from Jo Thornley. She says, "I cancelled my trip to London because I'm told snails do not wear hats there. This is a valid and understandable reason." And Peter, if I may, just for a moment,
please
speak fluent London for you, because as you can hear, I am from London.
Indeed.
Graham Puttock replies to @RealDonaldTrump. "No worries, mate. Let's reschedule for when you're less racist."
Okay. Look, I think that's a good segue to go into this next part of our conversation.
Segue.
Yeah, so thank you for that.
You're welcome.
Donald Trump is getting into some hot water for his comments. We're not going to say them here. I've already said them on the air mm-hmm. today, so we're not going to do that again. Many people know what he said already and have been offended by them, but how is social media dealing with that?
Oh, goodness me, Peter. Online potty mouth everywhere on Facebook, on Twitter. I'm going to use the word toilet instead of the word that the president used so that I can get through some of the online comments that are coming from other places around the world. From Kenya, Boniface Mwangi is a really well-known tweeter, really well-known on social media. He says, "Africa isn't a toilet. It's the most beautiful continent in the world. Beautiful, hardworking people. We have diamonds and gold and iron, cobalt, uranium, copper, bauxite, silver, petroleum, cocoa, coffee, tea, etc. Sadly, we have toilet leaders like Trump dumping on us every day." That's one view from Kenya. And you may remember the former president of Mexico, Vicente Fox. The heat of "I am not paying for that bleeping war."
He uses salty language himself, right?
All of the time. He talks to the president. @RealDonaldTrump, "Your mouth is the foulest toilet in the world. With what authority do you proclaim who's welcome in America and who's not? America's greatness is built on diversity, or have you forgotten your immigrant background, Donald?"
I was on social media and I've been noticing people from Haiti taking absolutely beautiful pictures of Haiti. Now,
I'm so glad you said that. Jacqueline Charles is one of the best reporters from the Caribbean and Haiti, and she works for the Miami Herald. And last night, as the president was sharing his thoughts, she pushed back and said, "These are some of the pictures that I've taken when I've been on assignment, when I've been on vacation, and they are stunning pictures of Haiti, which is a gorgeous, amazing country, obviously with many, many issues that we all know about and we've reported about. But today of all days is the 8th anniversary of the Haiti earthquake. So Haitians are dealing with what they perceive and what they... let's just say racism from President Trump on the day that they're remembering the tragedy of the earthquake in Haiti 8 years ago.
Femi, you mentioned a few minutes ago that you are from London.
Yes,
but
I am.
You are of Nigerian descent. Normally we talk about social media, but I want to ask, you know, how this is going over with you.
It reminds me of when I was growing up in London and the UK. I grew up in a place called Kent, which, if you imagine, New Hampshire in the 1960s. I was a little brown girl in the countryside, and people would come up and touch my hair and touch my woolly hair because it had an unusual texture, because most of the people around where I lived were white and English, and they didn't really understand the culture of other countries. And these comments, which are allegedly coming from President Trump, which he's now walking back, says he didn't say.
Well, remind U.S. me senators this, are confirming that he said it.
Exactly. Remind me of the 60s and the 70s and the 80s when we were actually just getting to grip with we are an international community. We are understanding cultures a lot better. And it just reminds me of that time when people would say to me, where are you really from? I said, I'm from London. No, where are you really from? Meaning, why are you black? And those comments from the president remind me that we cannot just make fun of them. We actually have to have that conversation and talk about racism. It's really important. And I thought we'd got past that time, but it's still with us. We can't ever relax.
Well, the issue of race, as you know, so complicated. There's another one going on social media. The mother of a young black boy who modeled a hoodie that read "Coolest Monkey in the Jungle" for retailer H&M, speaking out after a week of online outrage. People were saying this ad was racist. She's saying, and look, we just have a second here, Femi. She's saying, you know, here, take a breath here for a minute.
Yeah, she's saying, chill, people. People were seeing this sweatshirt the little boy was wearing, the coolest monkey in the jungle. They said it's racist. It refers to black people as being monkeys. They didn't like it. The mum, Terry Mango, took to Facebook and she says, this is an unnecessary issue. Get over it.
Femi O'Kane, host of The Stream on Al Jazeera English. Always a pleasure, Femi. Thank you.
You're welcome, Peter. Take care.
This podcast and following message sponsored by WBUR.
Hi, I'm Ben Brock Johnson, here to introduce you to Endless Thread, a new podcast from WBUR and Reddit featuring stories that capture the internet's endless permutations of human potential.
Even though it's like this huge network with millions of users, you know, there's still that kind of like small world connection there.
Endless Thread, supported by ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire, and by Wistia, where videos get put to work. Learn more at wbur.org/endlessthread and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
Here's another way that the GOP tax cut could affect your wallet. Your utility bill may go down. Electric companies in a number of states have already announced that they will pass the savings they receive from lower taxes onto their customers. Michael Regan is senior editor at Bloomberg News, and he joins us now to talk about it. Hi there, Mike.
Hi, Meghna.
So, first of all, where are these customers who are going to see these lower rates?
Well, it's important to make a distinction depending on what type of utility we're talking about. Now, some utilities are actually run by the local governments and they're not paying taxes already, so they won't be affected at all. But many utilities are run by actual for-profit corporations, so they will be the ones to look at in this case. And so far, 18 states, including New York, California, many others, and probably more will jump on the bandwagon too, are basically pressing the nation's top energy regulator to make sure that utilities pass on any tax savings that they get onto consumers. And this is, you know, not basically through the goodness of their own hearts that utilities will be doing this. They have to go to state regulators for approval for what they do. And the attorney generals of various states are trying to sort of make sure that this happens right away, that they pass on these savings as soon as they can.
Right. So there's a lot of state regulation for many of these utilities, but they also, many of them have local and regional monopolies because of the nature of the business. I mean, how much are those companies being taxed right now? Is it the same as other corporations?
Yeah, looking at the effective tax rate for just the utilities in the S&P 500, I mean, it varies like any other company, depending on what they're able to write off, how much profit they made, and that sort of things. Of the utilities in the S&P 500 that are paying taxes, the average rate is almost 30%. So it's pretty high compared to, say, all multinational corporations, because most publicly traded utility companies are domestically focused. They operate almost entirely in the United States. So their tax rate is a little bit higher than, say, a company that does a lot of business overseas and is getting taxed at lower rates in other countries.
I see. And maybe they don't have a lot of foreign money to repatriate to the United States either.
Exactly, yeah. Right.
Well, so as you said, since some of these companies are publicly listed, they've got shareholders, meaning that those shareholders will expect as good a performance as possible. So if these utilities are cutting their rates for some of their customers now, how long can we actually expect that to last?
Well, you know, as long as the tax cuts last, that should reduce utility rates for customers of these companies going forward.
Well, the corporate rate is supposed to be forever, the new corporate rate, right?
Exactly. Or at least until the next administration decides to change it. But it's not quite as simple as it sounds. I was talking to one of our energy experts here, Liam Denning, and he mentioned, well, there's also an element of the tax bill that limits the amount of deductions you can take for interest on debt. And a lot of these utility companies have a lot of debt because they're very stable, reliable businesses. But to build out a big, power transmission system often requires taking on a lot of debt. So some of them will not be able to deduct as much for their interest rates. So it will sort of have a mitigating effect.
Mm. Well, Mike Regan, senior editor at Bloomberg News. Always a pleasure, Mike. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Megan.
Fort Collins, Colorado is one of the latest cities to move forward with a plan to offer broadband to its residents as a utility. The city would act as an internet service provider and ensure net neutrality, or the requirement that internet providers such as Comcast treat all internet traffic equally. That's despite the Federal Communications Commission's scrapping of net neutrality last month. Well, joining us now via Skype is Fort Collins Mayor Wade Troxell. And Mayor Troxell, Fort Collins voters approved municipal broadband back in November, and I'm seeing that you're estimating you'll take on about $150 million in debt to roll this out over the next 5 years. So I guess let's get to the bottom line. Who's going to be setting the rate for this utility?
So, yes, it will be a competitive enterprise, but the Fort Collins City Council will be the determiner of the rate structure.
Okay. This is really fascinating, Mayor Troxell. I have to say, I mean, I imagine, well, I don't have to imagine. I'm pretty sure Comcast is not happy at all with this.
No, so basically we put together a business plan and really engaged our citizenry, took it to the vote, and it passed 57%. And with that, a citizen committee in a community put together a campaign that cost about $15,000. The incumbents put together a campaign to fight it that was over $900,000. And so it was really a David and Goliath kind of battle, if you will, at the election. And the citizens really came out on top of that battle.
You know, Comcast, through this campaign against the creation of the municipal broadband, I'm seeing that they were claiming that, for example, if the city moved forward with the project, that things like road repair, affordable housing, and other priorities couldn't be met in Fort Collins.
And that's totally misinformation, to put it kindly. You know, it's really not taking away from our priorities. We're a AAA bonded city, are very fiscally sound. We do deliver great services to our community, and all those sorts of things demonstrate, I think, that the citizens have a high degree of trust in the way our municipal government is run, and it was demonstrated with a convincing win at the ballot box regarding municipal broadband.
Yeah. You know, a lot of people, one of the major gripes they have about their internet service providers is that they have no choice, right? For that very reason of whoever owns the line that goes to their house is the ISP. So for all those people who like to complain about Comcast, part of the reason why is because they can't get internet from anyone else, and they're beholden to the service that Comcast provides. So how do you propose sort of avoiding the same pitfalls or same complaints that folks have of the that they might have with municipal broadband?
Well, actually, we're entering a competitive space with the incumbents, and we need to reach a 30% take rate in terms of the municipal utility. We expect about a 50% take rate. And so there will be a choice, and I think we're operating a more cost-effective alternative than the competitors that we will face as a municipal broadband.
I see. So overall, I mean, what do you make of the fact that it seems like some 185 communities across the United States are working on similar projects as Fort Collins has undertaken? I mean, is this sort of like a grassroots-level uprising against Internet service providers? What is it? What do you think?
You know, I think it's a natural evolution of what we've seen in our other utilities. And I think it becomes so integral to our life and our needs. And so taking off the lid of our broadband will be a critical aspect to our future.
So final question for you, Mr. Mayor. Are you concerned about remaining competitive with the private ISPs? Because they may end up, you know, in the future, having the money and resources to improve their broadband offerings that maybe the city of Fort Collins might not have.
Well, I'm confident that when this is rolled out, that there will be a lot of advertising and other sorts of things, maybe some cost cutting on their part. We've seen that with other cities that have rolled out broadband. We're anticipating that, and we're going to provide a municipal service that is what our citizens have asked for at the ballot box.
Well, Wade Troxell is the mayor of Fort Collins, Colorado. Mayor Troxell, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you so much, Magna. Appreciate it. Thank you.
And now an update on Nevada rancher Cliven Bundy and his family. The self-styled militiamen have emerged victorious in two federal trials after the 2014 armed standoff in Bunkerville, Nevada, and the 2016 occupation of the Malheur National Wildlife Refuge in Oregon. Oregon Public Broadcasting's Amanda Peacher tells us what's next for the Bundy movement and its opponents.
About a dozen Bundy supporters are celebrating at a Mexican restaurant in Redmond, Oregon. It's just a few hours after U.S. District Judge Gloria Navarro dismissed criminal charges against Cliven Bundy and his sons. One of the group organizers, B.J. Soper, raises his glass.
Here's to 2 years' worth of justice being served.
Amen.
Cheers.
2 years ago, Bundy sons Ammon and Ryan were arrested for their armed takeover of the Malheur National Wildlife Refuge. They were eventually acquitted by a jury. And now this week, Judge Navarro declared a mistrial in the Nevada Bundy case. The Bundys faced felony conspiracy and weapons charges after Cliven Bundy led a standoff against government officials. The conflict came about because Bundy refused to pay fees to graze his cattle. The judge said the government purposely withheld key evidence in the trial and called its conduct outrageous.
This is very vindicating.
That's Bundy supporter Kim Fritz. She says the judge affirmed her beliefs that the government was lying. For example, prosecutors delayed turning over documents that proved there were government snipers outside the Bundy Nevada ranch during the conflict.
For the judge to finally realize that and come out and say it is just really amazing.
Both Bundy trials have been a rallying cause for people who distrust federal agencies like the Bureau of Land Management. B.J. Soper says he gave up running two businesses to focus on the so-called Patriot Movement.
You know, I've done nothing else in my life for 2 years.
Soper organized fundraisers for the Bundys' wives and children.
I felt a call to make sure that they're okay until their husbands were home.
Now free from jail, the Bundys seem ready to continue their fight. At a press conference Wednesday in Nevada, family patriarch Cliven Bundy continued to buck the BLM's right to control the federal land where his cows graze.
I graze my cattle only on Clark County, Nevada land, and I have no contract with the federal government.
It's not yet clear what the next steps will be for the Bundys and their followers. Some want pardons for the other defendants who took plea deals before trial. Others are running for local office. Many, like Kim Fritz, want to see local control of federal public lands.
They're closing it off from us right and left.
to preserve whatever animal or species or just flat out historical site.
Fritz believes that the states, not the federal government, should own public lands.
There's no grounds for any legal argument here.
John Freemuth is a professor of environmental policy at Boise State University.
The solution to this, from a Bundy perspective, certainly not many other people, but his, would be to get Congress to transfer the federal lands to states.
But transferring federal lands to states remains a fringe idea and isn't on any congressional agenda right now. Opponents of the Bundys worry that the ranchers could initiate another standoff.
Nobody wants to go through that whole occupation thing again.
Liz Appleman lives in Harney County, the site of the Oregon refuge occupation. Appleman was disappointed when the Bundys were acquitted in the Oregon trials.
So a lot of people, myself including, was hoping Nevada would have them pay some sort of price for what they did, and the government screwed it up.
What's clear at this point is that both trials left the Bundys and their supporters feeling empowered by what they view as a righteous fight. Outside the Las Vegas courthouse on Monday, Oregon occupation leader Ammon Bundy declared that the Lord had given his family an advantage.
He motivated us to stand, and then he delivered us in the end and gave us great advantage in the courtroom.
Back in the Mexican restaurant, Ammon Bundy's supporters echo that belief and cheer for the Bundy's legal team.
Yeah, how about Ryan Bundy?
Yes.
I think he was probably the best lawyer out of the group.
That's because he had God on his side.
That's it.
The other Bundy supporters around their table raise their glasses and say amen. For Here and Now, I'm Amanda Peacher in Redmond, Oregon.
Let's talk about sports and sports leagues. Not football or basketball, but esports. To explain, we're joined now by Ben Johnson. He covers tech for Here and Now and is the host of the podcast Endless Thread, which launches today. Hey there, Ben.
Hi, Meghna.
Okay, so let me put on my best public radio voice.
Okay.
Electronic sports? Pray tell, what might you mean, Mr. Johnson?
Okay, so here's how I would describe it to the uninitiated. It's professional video gaming. Teams, tournaments, arenas, in real life and on the screen. And really, these days, esports look a lot like regular sports in terms of how they're organized and the kind of economy growing around them. Esports are growing crazy fast.
Okay, so we've got this week a major event in the esports world happening in California called the Overwatch League? So
yeah.
What is that? And I see tickets for some of these events have sold out.
So esports as an industry, like I said, is growing. Some events are packing out huge arenas. Think Madison Square Garden in New York. Overwatch League is kind of new. It's run by the game maker and publisher Blizzard Entertainment. And this is actually a newer, smaller example based around the game called Overwatch, which has been hugely popular. It's what's called a first-person shooter. You have these teams of players pitted against each other. It's sort of a cartoonish version of a shooting game. Players control characters with special abilities. Those characters are separated into teams. And Blizzard, the company that makes the game, is really designing this new league in a way that traditional sports are designed. There's a regular season. There are permanent teams, the whole deal.
Wow. Okay, so regular season, permanent teams, professional players. A lot of these folks have managers. So, I mean, what kind of money are we talking about here, both in terms of how much the players make and how much the owners of the league, I guess, make?
Yeah. So revenue in 2017 for the industry was estimated at around $700 million. By 2020, some projections say esports will be at $1 or $1.5 billion in annual revenue. In comparison to maybe an NFL player, esport players make a pretty meager salary, from the companies that pay them, maybe five or six figures. But prize money is often in the millions of dollars for a single event or tournament. Sponsorships, clothing, energy drinks, computer equipment. Players can make a lot if they're successful. But they also age out like regular sports players, which is really interesting. You know, reaction times to what you see on the screen, clicking a mouse button even, your ability to do that quickly, that tops out for most people in their early 20s. And players can't keep those reaction times up, and those are essential to winning. So the ownership part of this is a little more confusing right now because it's still still kind of, it's a nascent industry. Game-making companies are involved, but so are more traditional names in sports. Patriots owner Robert Kraft owns the Boston Uprising Overwatch team. Shaq is an owner in this arena as well.
Robert Kraft owns an Uprising team?
Yeah, yeah.
Wow,
yeah, Overwatch team, yep.
See, I learned something new every day here. Okay, so this league has fans, mm-hmm. and as you just talked about, owners are putting in some money here. Mm-hmm. But the question is, you know, when you were making the comparison to the NFL, most popular sport in the United States, do esports have the ability to really scale up in a major way into the mainstream?
So I've been a skeptic in the past, Magna. But let's think about this for a second, right? Traditional sports are often, for the fans, you're sitting on your butt watching someone else play, right? And there's really no difference between that setup and what happens in the esport world, which has all the drama, all the tension and release and euphoria of more physical sports. And as connectivity and online gaming evolves and develops, I don't think there's any reason to expect that this sport won't grow in popularity. A lot of the same ingredients are there. And with new generations of digital natives coming into their own and having money to spend on recreation, you're going to, I think, see a lot more of these kinds of sporting events become more mainstream in the next 5, 10, 15 years and so on.
Now, Ben, before I let you go, your new podcast, Endless Thread, launches today.
Yes.
Exciting. Tell us a little bit about it.
So Endless Thread is a podcast that really delves deeply into Reddit, which is a website a lot of people know. If you're not a Redditor, you might make some assumptions about Reddit, you know, that it's a place for trolls, things like that. But it's actually just this amazing, vast ecosystem of different communities. And really, that's what Endless Thread is doing. We're digging into the comments section, which I know is dangerous sometimes. but really, we're finding some amazing stories from real people who are active on Reddit. Everything from people who are doing their dissertations with help from studying Reddit communities to people. We have an episode coming up about just this guy who lived homeless for several months in New York City, and he popped up on this thread about whether or not you should give money to panhandlers. Huh. And he had this personal story that we got interested in. He has this crazy life story. He was a Jehovah's Witness growing up. His family rejected him for being gay. He lived homeless for months in New York City and then sort of got himself back onto his feet through this strength of character. And he now works for the Bronx District Attorney's Office.
Wow.
So we're just finding amazing sort of real people and real stories among the comment threads of Reddit.
All right. So Endless Thread, I'm going to put it on my download list.
Please do.
Ben Johnson covers tech for Here and Now and host of the new podcast, Endless Thread. Thanks so much, Ben.
Thank you, Megna.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Megna Chakrabarty.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now.